I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. This week, Florida celebrates the 500th anniversary of Spanish navigator Juan Ponce de León's arrival in the Sunshine State. But author and journalist T.D. Allman says we should take a closer look at the facts of Ponce de León's discovery and the last 500 years of Florida history. Allman spent a decade researching his new book, Finding Florida, The True History of the Sunshine State. I'll talk with T.D. Allman about Florida's dark past and the future of this state. Also, in the wake of Hugo Chavez's death, Venezuela prepares for a presidential election. How will it change U.S. relations with Venezuela, and what impact will it have on Venezuelan Americans living in Florida? To answer those questions, I'll talk with Trudy Morales, Professor of Political Science at the University of Central Florida, and Honors Political Science student Roman Torres. That's ahead on Intersection. I'm joined in the studio by journalist and author T.D. Allman. Mr. Allman, your book is entitled Finding Florida, The True History of the Sunshine State, and you make a point that the myth-making that surrounds Florida goes right back to Ponce de León. Can you explain some of that background?
Yes, it goes back even further than that, but let's start there. The myth of the Fountain of Youth was made up about 1930, and the Spanish were here for 250 years, and they never named anything after Ponce de León. It was Washington Irving who made up the Ponce myth. The real founder of Florida was a fellow named Menendez de Aviles, and it was the early version of the Cuban Missile Crisis. The Spanish kept sending expeditions here. They all died, got lost, and the King of Spain actually described Florida quite accurately. He said her soil is too sandy, her harbors are too shallow to permit of effective settlement, and he forbade further expeditions here. And these are people who had no trouble climbing over the Andes or conquering Mexico, but Florida defeated them. Well, that was the case until they found out the French had made a settlement at Jacksonville. So Menendez tore across the Atlantic. He found them and he killed them all. And, you know, we always, the moral exceptionalism of the New World is the greatest myth of all. Florida's history began with the first mass slaughter of white men by white men in the New World. And if you go to, he founded St. Augustine. Ponce de León never went near St. Augustine. He chose St. Augustine because it was a convenient place to go attack the French. And to this day, the harbor there is called Matanzas Bay, which in Spanish means slaughter.
Let's just talk about, I suppose, the perception of people coming into Florida, because obviously it's a state that derives its population from immigration. And you say in your book that people who came into the state and had a viewpoint or policies that didn't really jibe with the what the ruling elite wanted were referred to as carpetbaggers and kind of run out of town. I mean, is that something that persists today, do you think?
Yes, it does. I mean, the myth of the carpetbaggers, the carpetbaggers were these horrible Yankees who came down. In truth, the only people they ran out of the town were people who would not become complicit in a system of injustice. And so there was the myth we're told in school is that after the Civil War, you had bad Reconstruction. All these Yankees came down and did horrible things, and then the good Southerners took back. That's not true. Under both periods, you had two Northern governors and one Florida-born governor. And probably the worst was the worst reactionary Reconstruction governor was a guy named Drew. He was from New Hampshire. He came to the South. The Union protected him. And then after the war, he made his money in logging, and he used the Ku Klux Klan to keep his workers in line. And his story, along with Flagler's, is very similar to Rick Scott's. People make their money on a transformative, and DeSoto's, and Ponce de León. For the early Spaniards, it was stealing gold. For Henry Flagler, it was the Industrial Revolution, and the petroleum, especially in the North. And for Rick Scott, it was our health care crisis. They make tons of money up north, and then Florida becomes their playground. And the interesting thing is they all either get wiped out or certainly wind up much poorer. Flagler said, I would have been a rich man if it weren't for Florida. And I would say to our listeners, if you want to get out of here alive and happy, just remember one thing. Florida consumes capital. It does not create wealth. Okay? And if you've got a lot of money, like I have a place in Miami. After many years, I'm very happy there. I like many aspects of life in Florida. But I have no dream that I'll make money on that, that by basing myself in Florida, it's going to be to my financial advantage.
Now, a lot of the people you talk about in this book are people who, for one reason or another, they come to Florida with great ambitions and those plans don't always work out as they thought they would. I think you say that people are always ruining Florida and Florida is ruining them back. And I just wanted to read a little quote from earlier on in the book. You say, this is kind of the way people sometimes approach Florida. They say, fell that pine barren, build a theme park, construct a gator community, then watch a sinkhole swallow up your Florida fantasy, an alligator devours your fox terrier, palmetto bugs infest your life. Do you think that people are learning from that? Or is that, I mean,
I'd just like to interject. Is that a truthful statement or not? You know, and they're always saying, the historians say, oh, he's so opinionated, you know, and he doesn't have anything good to say. I didn't write that sentence to be clever, let me put it away. I write to be insightful all the time, but I mean, that's a factual statement.
Well, let's talk about that too. I mean, you know, a large chunk of this book makes for quite uncomfortable reading. You know, you talk about the Seminole War, the Civil War, and then Reconstruction, and through the history of segregation in Florida. And I want to ask you, T.D. Orman, do you think Floridians have fully come to terms with the state's history of racial discrimination?
I think they're hardly aware it exists. I mean, I think that's the great problem. You see, that's the problem of when you live in this fake historical goo. In truth is, intellectually, there's no distinction between the theme parks and the reality. And in fact, the unfortunate thing is that some of the theme parks, superficial as they are, they're better than the monuments around Florida. If you go up to a Lustig, now, there's a place where I-10 and I-75 make sort of a Confederate cross. And a Lustig is right near that intersection. And this is considered your great Confederate victory. Jefferson David and Beauregard were disgusted because the Florida troops, who had a small success over the Yankees, instead of pursuing them, they paused to kill black people. That was not the word they used, of course. And I say this is the real slavery. You know, the only difference was blacks were killing back this time. And, you know, the great myth of the Civil War here is it was these Yankee soldiers came down. That's not true at all. Florida loyalists, white Florida loyalists, what one eyewitness called the better sort of cracker, they were loyal to the Union. They may not have liked black people. They may even have supported slavery, but they loved America. And the other were the tens and hundreds of thousands of freed black men who fought on the Union side. And, you know, I look at them and I call them the first responders. You know, they're the guys today, you know, when you have to call the fire department or your kid gets in trouble or your cat goes down a well, they show up. And, you know, they are sneered out of most histories of Florida. And yet it goes all the way back to another key event, which I describe in the book, the massacre at Negro Fort, where you had a black man, probably a free man, and a Choctaw Indian. And Jackson said, go down and kill them. And they were killed. And they fought together. My heart goes out to them all. You know, I feel no loyalty to the Dick and Jane version. My loyalty, my love, my tears go to the people who constantly struggle to make Florida better than it is.
Let's talk about transportation for a minute. Reading through the section of this book where you talk about the three Henrys, Flagler, Sanford, and Plant, it's interesting just to, you know, think about, we have these stupendously wealthy folks that are building this network of rail lines and linking up hotels across Florida. And I want to ask you, T.D. Orman, how crucial do you think that sort of early history of rail in Florida was to setting up the tourism economy we have now in the Sunshine State?
Oh, it was very important. You see, they latched on to railroads during the railroad age. And the railroads brought people down here, of course, first tourists in the age of the private railway car. But also it made the export of Florida products possible for the first time. Refrigeration, for the first time, you could export crops. There are very few crops that thrive in Florida's limestone, but they are oranges and they're strawberries, so that helped. Then the interesting thing was the next phase runs right through here. Is it Dixie Highway goes through here? That was a private thing. That was the guy who started Oldsmobile, Fisher. Carl Fisher, and they built that highway to bring down. Now we have the airports are the great nodes, MCO, which is not ORL. See, I know that. Brings people in here, and look at the results you have. The best Indian food in Florida and the United States, best South Indian food, wonderful Hindu temples, things like that. So the next question, we're now at the cusp of the motor car era. And the question is, what happens next? Now, all these civilizations are extremely resilient. Remember, even racism. Why did it survive so long? Why did slavery? Well, it was very bad to black people, but it brought white people together. I mean, I'm just speaking very honestly now. So as long as you were white, it was okay. So that was the very thing. Now what we have to look at now is what happens next to societies that have large populations that are built on environmentally fragile foundations, that have very few natural resources, and unfortunately don't have very many human resources in comparison to natural competitors like California, for instance, at a time when energy costs are rising. That's the next drama of Florida. What happens next?
I mean, you do paint a rather bleak picture of Florida in this book. You know, people coming here seeking something that isn't there and then sort of failing at trying to create that paradise. But there are sort of glimmers of optimism too. I just want to read another quote here talking about the sort of commerce that sprung up around the outskirts of Disney. And you say, the dollar stores and fast food franchises cling to the edges of Disney World like junkyard scrap drawn to a gigantic magnet. Yet the wackiness, the wildness, the gratuitous inventiveness that make America, America are also on display. And then you go on to talk about the different sort of cultures that...
I love Kissimmee. I mean, if it was like the Lady and the Tiger and they said, you have to spend the rest of your life either in Epcot or in Kissimmee, I'd say, take me to Kissimmee. Take me to Kissimmee right now. Because you see people living there and doing things. I wanted to mention somebody else. There are many, many heroes in Florida history. But the one who probably, one of the most interesting is a guy named Ossian Hart. If anybody was a real Floridian, it was Ossian Hart. He was the first Florida-born governor. He was elected during Reconstruction. And, of course, they called him a scallywag. See, if you all know about that. And he balanced the budget. He integrated the schools. He said there's plenty of room for everybody under the old flag, by which he meant the United States flag. And he was a great man and a great Floridian, and he has been completely removed from history. But there is a great book on him called Ossian Hart, written by a wonderful professor who never got tenure in Florida, who never got a department in Florida, is now in Georgia. Cantor Brown, go out and buy that book. I'd rather have you buy that book than my book, though you can buy both. And, you know, Florida is full of wonderful people like that. And one of the things, it's just been a joy rescuing them to a little bit. You know, I carry them in my arms to the book. And at the end, I address them for the first time by their first names, Billy and so on. Now I can tell you. And I remember something about them. There's a wonderful book on the French in the medieval times called Montaillou, and you should buy that book too before you buy my book. And it's about this shepherd, and you read the story, and I was reading it in France one time, and I realized life is always worth having been lived. And it's just a joy to me that, you know, I read them, and maybe some people will know they did not live in vain.
I've been speaking to T.D. Allman. He's the author of Finding Florida, The True History of the Sunshine State. I want to thank you for coming in.
It's been a joy.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 WMFE-FM. I'm Matthew Petty. You can join the conversation on Facebook or Twitter or email us at intersection@wmfe.org. Next, a conversation about Venezuela's upcoming presidential election. This month, Venezuelans go to the polls to elect a successor to Hugo Chavez, who died of cancer in March. Many expect acting President Nicolas Maduro to beat his challenger, opposition leader Enrique Capriles. Florida is home to more than 100,000 Venezuelans. They'll be watching the April 14th election closely. To talk about the upcoming Venezuelan election, I spoke to Dr. Trudy Morales, a professor of political science at the University of Central Florida. I asked Dr. Morales to explain the relationship between the United States and Venezuela and whether she sees any changes in the future.
I think that, at least for the short term, the relationship is not going to improve significantly. I think, however, over time, there probably will be some kind of rapprochement or some kind of more opening in the relationship. The development model that Chavez followed is another catch-22. He followed this new 21st century socialist model, which he didn't just impose on Venezuela. He used the oil riches of the country to give oil subsidies at good, decent, we should say, oil energy prices to smaller Caribbean countries and major other Latin American countries, Uruguay, Bolivia, Paraguay, Cuba, forgetting Cuba. The press often emphasizes that he's giving all of this cheap oil to Cuba, and we don't often hear how he's given all of this as well to people in New York and, of course, to some Caribbean countries and poor Latin American countries. And he has done that in part because he was trying to balance the power of capitalist forces, power of IMF, the Washington consensus economic model, which is dominated by privatization and market forces, give them some balance in Latin American countries. In doing so, he has tapped the populism and the views of Latin Americans across the spectrum. And I'm talking even of some conservative governments, because they benefit in part by a stronger Latin American presence as a balance against the United States.
That was UCF political science professor Dr. Trudy Morales. Joining me in the studio to talk more about Venezuelans in Florida is Roman Torres. Roman was born in Venezuela and moved to Central Florida in 2001 at the age of 16. He's now an honors student of political science at the University of Central Florida. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So, Roman, let's talk a little bit about how you came to be in the United States. Now, you were born in Venezuela and you moved to Central Florida. What brought you to Florida?
Sometimes people forget that there's a political history in Venezuela before Hugo Chavez. And some people almost feel like it has always been there, almost like a Castro thing, you know. But before Hugo Chavez comes into the political arena in Venezuela, and, you know, he first came in as a revolutionary. Back in 1992, he staged a coup against the government that was in Venezuela back then.
And it failed, right?
Yeah, it was a fail, exactly. And it was a reaction to something that happened a few years before that, where there were some major protests in the streets of Caracas and in all major cities in Venezuela, because the Venezuelan government had just decided to take in this IMF restructuring plan. And, you know, like typical IMF policies, a lot of it had to do with giving things to the private sector and whatnot and ending subsidies.
So he was in the military at the time that was called in to quell the protests?
Right. Yeah, he was. And so was my dad. My father is a military officer, too. He had to also like decide like which side am I gonna go to, sort of thing, you know. So we're living through that, you know, pretty up close. The Caracas was what it was called. It was like a social explosion, and people started looting, and it was really bad. And there was, you know, the numbers of death are contested and whatnot, but it was really high, and most of them were from security forces. So there was a kind of almost like an overwhelming notion that this government was putting foreign investors first. Or their interests first. And this is what Chavez exploits today, you know. But after the Caracaso, then in 1992, you had the coup d'etat. Chavez comes in as this revolutionary trying to topple the government and bring forth this like social revolution. So this is the same guy that Venezuelans remember when he was running in 1998. You're like, this is the same guy that we saw before. So obviously, people that had a lot of wealth were really worried. And including those were private companies, corporations, and including that was Canon, and my mom was working for Canon. And we're from Maracaibo, which is in the northwest of Venezuela, so we're not from Caracas, but we're from the second biggest city. So Canon, I think, just decided to only leave the Caracas office open and kind of like trim down around the country. So all of a sudden, my mom found herself unemployed. Mm-hmm. And I think like most families that aren't consider themselves middle class and all of a sudden they find themselves without a source of income, they never really expected that would happen. And she tried to open a little business doing printing and whatnot right next to the university. It didn't really work out as well. And then she saw coming to the United States as sort of like a last resort option. And I was only 16 at the time, so I didn't really have much of a choice, you know, so I just came with her. I guess it's a mixture of things. You could say that we moved here because of the political situation, but in an indirect way, because of Cannon's decision, I guess, you know?
Right.
But after coming in 2001, I kind of got to witness a little bit of the rest of the people coming in, and a lot of them come because of issues, you know, big issues with the situation, the political situation, and the social situation.
Right. And I suppose in the years that Chavez was in power, more Venezuelans decided to move and move to the United States, and particularly Florida, I think South Florida especially.
Right, right, definitely. And it's interesting because living in Florida, we kind of get to see, we get to see it more vividly that someone that decided to move, say, to like Canada, you know? And I think a lot of it has to do with this this hope that you're going to go back eventually, mm-hmm. like pretty soon, you know, once it gets better. And you guys were asking, well, how does this affect Central Florida? And I think that's where it comes in to place. Some industries are thinking, well, what if all these Venezuelans decide to go back? And what's that going to mean to the region? You know, to be completely honest, I think that the Venezuelan love affair with Florida is not really going to go anywhere, even if things get better.
Roman, I wonder if you can talk a little bit about currency control in Venezuela. What have you learned from your research about the effects of currency control while Hugo Chavez was president?
More than research, I think I can. The best things I can tell you is just experiencing myself by going back and forth. Imagine if you had a choice to go to a country. Where are you from?
I'm from New Zealand.
From New Zealand. So imagine that you had a choice when you go to New Zealand to exchange your money at a 4.3 rate or at a 25 rate. You know, that's pretty much what's happening. You have an exchange control that was put in place back in 2005, and this was to somewhat manage capital outflow out of Venezuela. And this is capital outflow, especially coming to the United States, going to Panama. Panama was another destination, like key destination for Venezuelan capital. And there's like what they call the electronic herd, the all capital going out of a country because of the political situation or whatnot. So this is like an exchange control, bam, all of a sudden, nobody can exchange money except for the government. So all these exchange houses and currency brokers and this entire sector of financial markets and the financial sector in Venezuela, it becomes illegal. Only the Venezuelan government is allowed to exchange. And this is not unique to Venezuela. This is happening in Argentina as well. This is happening in Iran. Like, I think it's places that have issues with balance of payments and having enough foreign currency to import stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So you can look at it as rationing it, you know, the Venezuelan government sits down and then says, so I'm gonna approve this much to you, I'm gonna approve this much to you, not to you. In a country like Venezuela, where there's widespread corruption in literally every layer of Venezuelan society, it's really bad, because then the people that have access to the preferential rate of being able to exchange bolivares, dollars, $1 for 4.3 bolivares, and then come turn around, we're selling it for 25. It's really tempting, you know, and it's really easy to become really corrupted.
Just as an example, let's say somebody with a lot of money in Venezuela decides they don't want to stay there anymore, they want to go somewhere like the United States.
Right.
They wouldn't be able to take their Venezuelan money and exchange it for US dollars and then leave the country.
They wouldn't be able to do it officially, but Venezuela is the land where everything is possible. Anything and everything that you might need has a price. So a person that's, even today, a person in 2013 that decided, you know what, I'm fed up with dealing with this. I'm going to go to a place where I don't have to deal with any of this stuff, can transfer their capital, but it's not going to be cheap. That's the only bad thing. So you can, you know, anybody can go to the black market. I think it sounds better to say parallel market, because when you say black market, it sounds like you're talking to some like evil man that is in a dark alley, but this could be really like your cousins that want to go on vacation next year and they're looking for dollars. And
so you're saying it's quite widespread?
Oh my gosh. There's a website in Venezuela called Lechuga Verde. It means green lettuce, greenlettuce.com. And green lettuce is the go-to website for anybody that wants to know where is the going rate for dollars in Venezuela. The illegal rate, literally. And it is so well established that I have my green lettuce app for my BlackBerry. And you can literally check on the go. You can check the price of nobody goes by the official rate because nobody has access to that. If you go to the mall, all the prices are based off the black dollar because you can't really purchase the preferential rate anyway. So why would you even base your business on that?
So for people visiting, like Venezuelans or tourists coming in, I mean, are they sort of besieged with people who want to buy foreign currency?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you don't see it in front of the airport or anything like that. I mean, this is, like I said, it's something that it's not supposed to happen. But I'm planning on going there now for 3 months. And as soon as I arrive there, there's going to be so many people that are going to want my dollars that I can literally just see who offers me the most and just give it to them. And like I said, I'm not talking about shady people in back alleys. I'm talking about friends, families, or all I have to say is just Facebook. I have $1,000 cash and I'm looking to exchange them who wants them.
Well, let's talk also about real estate. Venezuelans, I think, have invested quite a bit of money into South Florida real estate in mm-hmm. particular. What's the rationale behind this?
It's a way of securing your wealth. So imagine that you have, you know, significant amounts of money in Venezuela, and then you see the current situation where, you know, I mean, imagine all of a sudden in the United States that the government said that you cannot take the money out of the country. You know, that sends a signal, especially to people that have a lot of money, that their money is not safe. And then there was also, Chavez had some policies that encourage expropriations and nationalizations, and sometimes the compensation really wasn't timely, and it wasn't very fair. It was kind of like, okay, this what you get is what you get, and you better be happy with it, sort of thing. So all this sense of insecurity made people feel like they had to transfer their wealth somewhere that would be safe, and if anything, it would be growing. So Panama was a good destination for that because they speak Spanish and it's easier for a lot of people that didn't really have to learn a different language or anything. But Miami in South Florida was almost like the obvious place to go. And after 2008, when we had our mortgage crisis, you know, we had a lot of short sales. So I think a lot of Venezuelans saw that as an opportunity to buy a lot of money.
What are Venezuelans in Florida doing leading up to the election? Are expatriate Venezuelans flocking to the polling booths wherever they may be to vote?
Yes, very much. Yeah, definitely. I was just in Miami, and right before coming back, I stopped by a Venezuelan restaurant, and I was just like chit-chatting with a lady that was like helping me with the food and whatnot. And she told me she's going. She booked her flight. She's gonna go on something like the 11th, and she's coming back on the 15th. She's going only to vote. And I mean, that's remarkable, you know, like. I think there's a sense of duty. And people I talk to, even if they're not able to go, they say, oh, man, I'm so mad. I wish I could be there and contribute and help. And so the people in Florida, or like the people that used to live in Venezuela and are now here, overwhelmingly are going to be going over there. And the ones that don't, wish they could.
I've been speaking with Roman Torres. Roman is a honors political science student at the University of Central Florida, specializing in Venezuela. We've been talking about the upcoming April 14th election in Venezuela. Roman, thank you very much for joining us.
Definitely. Thank you for having me.
The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at wmfe.org/intersection. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Brendan Byrne is assistant producer. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.